I seldom ever mention anyone as visiting with us for several reasons. There are so many here who are visiting, it would be a futile task. But I would like to mention a man and his wife that are here who've been friends of mine over the years. We were in school together. Hillard Story and his wife are back here. Hillard, would you and your wife stand and let us see you just a minute so we'll... This good man and his wife are here in the city. They've been living here about a year. He teaches out at the Central and preaches at the Southside Church. And every once in a while, I'll see them sneak in here for our 4 o'clock service before they go out to the Southside Church. And I just have always thought so much of him. I appreciate him, and I want you to know him. If you will, be sure to meet them tonight. Others of you who are visiting, forgive me for not calling your names, but you understand why. As Neil said, we can either do that or we can have the class. We have so many visitors with us, and we're always thankful for your presence. The announcements tonight regarding the sick set a tone for the lesson, really. And you'll see why in just a moment. You know, we've viewed Jesus over the last several weeks on Sunday evenings from various aspects and from various angles. We've taken what you might call snapshots of him from these different viewpoints. We've noticed him as the Christ child. We noticed him as the youth, as the tempted, as Jesus the storyteller, Jesus the mixer. No one of these by itself gives the complete picture of Jesus. And frankly, none of these, when you put them all together, the group does not represent Jesus, because there's much more that we have not said that we will say in this series. And then when that's finished, I suppose you'd have to say that even that is not complete, because there's so much more that can be said that we'll not be able to say, and much that we'll not be able even to see about him. But all of these contribute to an understanding of the Son of God. And it's my prayer and my hope, as we study these lessons in his life, that what will happen is that he'll be lifted up high so that you'll see him and can be drawn to him out of a heart of love as you respond to his goodness and his greatness. And that's the reason why we're studying these lessons in his life. If one facet above all others could be chosen that would more nearly represent the Lord in his perfect presence, and I say this with qualification and almost with hesitation because of the way it affected me when I first read a statement that related to it. If we could single out one particular aspect of his life, at least among the people whom he came to save, it would be Jesus as the Comforter. Jesus the Comforter. When I first read some material on this, I thought, no, I don't believe that's right. But as I began to explore in the life of Christ, I began to see that that is right. The Beatitudes, the basic tone of those statements is comfort. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Each of these Beatitudes expresses a compensation for the quality that is stated. Blessed are those that mourn. The compensation is they shall be comforted. So the tone of the Beatitudes is comfort. The list of the I Ams in the book of John especially give those qualities, or those, well, they're not, they're properties. When Jesus says, I am the bread of life, I am the door, I am the good shepherd, he didn't say this specifically, but he says that he gives the water of life. When he talks about it, he says, I am the light, and so many other properties with which he identifies and says, I am this particular kind of thing, I'm this property. He always refers to those properties that have to do with the meeting of human needs. People need light, they need food, they need water, they need rest, they need a shepherd, they need saving, they need pasture, they need all of these things. And Jesus simply identifies himself with the human need. When he said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you together like a hen gathers her chicks under her wing, and you would not." He refers to a gesture that reaches out and touches people and communicates this quality of sympathy and of comfort, of reassurance, like a hen would put her wings around her brood. This is the quality that Jesus communicated by that simple, homey gesture, a homey figure. The great invitation where he said, "Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me." Come on. "I'm meek and lowly in heart. You'll find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy. My burden is light." What a beautiful statement of compassion and of communicating this concern and comfort. "Come on, I'll give you rest." Well, his description of his own ministry in Luke, the 4th chapter, where he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." He stood up in his own town of Nazareth in the synagogue, "because he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." Listen to all the comfort that he gives to the poor, to the captives, to the blind, to the oppressed. You hear these words, and do you hear what he says, that "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me"? This is my ministry, this is my work, to bring comfort to the poor, to the downtrodden, to the captives, to the blind. This was why he came, he said. And so you find that just as Jesus described his own ministry in this light, he also, when he determined and described the coming of his Spirit, after he would leave, he said, "It's for your advantage that I go away." He described the coming of his Spirit in this simple expression, the paraclete. The paraclete, the comforter, as the King James defines or interprets it or translates it. The comforter. Others, the counselor. But nevertheless, I'm forced to the conclusion that it is, more nearly than not, it is that quality of comfort that would more nearly describe Jesus than perhaps any other quality, if you're talking about his effect upon the people who received him. The common people accepted him, and it was to these common people that he communicated comfort. It was the religious leaders, the super religious people, that Jesus Christ could not be looked upon as a comforter. They didn't view him as a comforter. They viewed him as a confronter, as an upsetter, as someone who disturbed, and as someone who rocked the boat. But Jesus didn't come for those people who would not accept him. He said, "I came to save the lost." And it was to the lost people that Jesus communicated this beautiful quality of comfort. Jesus met the human crisis head on and spoke comfort to it. When I speak of human crisis, I'm talking about those things that each one of us will go through in our lives as people. The human crises, that of fear, anxiety, that of death, that of the guilt of sin, loneliness, all of these particular times in life that we ourselves will walk by ourselves often, to these instances and incidences, Jesus speaks comfort. And he speaks it with such words as these. These occur more than once in the story of his life. "Take heart, my son, your sins are forgiven." This happened one day when he was at home, and Luke, I think it was, that said he was at home. This was in Capernaum. He perhaps had a rented house there, I don't know. But nevertheless, it describes him as being at home. And the other gospel, Matthew, says that he was in his own hometown, or he was at... Well, what was that Matthew said? Matthew 9, 2. See what he uses an expression there. He was in his own city. He was in his own city. But by this time, he had already moved from Nazareth to Capernaum. So his own city was not the place where he was raised. His own city was Capernaum. And it was while he was there at home, Luke says, that this disruption came up. Someone tore up his roof, just tore the roof off of his house and let these people down. Well, instead of saying, "What are you doing? That's my roof," he said, "Be of good cheer, son. Your sins are forgiven." Encouraging somebody while they're tearing up his roof. Well, that sounds like it, because we'll notice some other things in a few moments. When he was in the home of Simon the Pharisee and the woman came in and was disturbed so much that she cried and wept over his feet, he told her, "Go in peace. Your faith has saved you." And after the feeding of the 5,000, when his disciples were so disturbed because they could not understand the event, if we read this properly, I think we'll see that the disciples were involved in this mass gathering out on the eastern shore, the southeast shore of the Sea of Galilee. They had assembled about 5,000 men there who were revolutionaries. Jesus fed them. When he saw that they were going to come and take him by force and make him king, he dismissed the crowd, made his disciples get in the boat, and it says he made them get in there. They went in there pouting. It gives us the indication that they were just undone, and they were sour. It says they were hardened. Their hearts were hardened. And he came on later, walking on the water. Difficult, you know, that's... But anyway, they saw him and were terrified. And he said to them, listen to this expression, "Take heart, it is I, don't be afraid." Here again, constantly telling people, "Don't be afraid, it's I. It's all right, take heart." And he got in the boat, and it says they sat there like sulled up possums. You know, they were hard-hearted. It says their hearts were hardened because they didn't understand that thing about the feeding of the 5,000. They did not understand about the loaves. Why did he not let them make him king? Why did he not let them do what they were trying to do? They didn't understand that, and they were put out with him. So he said, "Don't be discouraged. It's all right. It's I. Don't be afraid. Everything's going to be all right." Well, look, he met these human needs. Anxiety over daily needs. I want to read just a few passages for your enjoyment. And listen, if you will, and let me just read them to you. But we'll not have time to turn to some of these. "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor about your body, what you shall put on. Isn't the life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a cubit to the span of his life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O men of little faith? Therefore don't be anxious, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For the Gentiles seek all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these will be yours as well. Therefore, don't be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Let the day's own trouble be sufficient for the day." Comfort in things that about which we become so anxious at times, those of daily needs. Comfort regarding fear. Fear of the elements. One time, it was shortly after he finished this Sermon on the Mount, they got into a boat, he got in with them, they went across to the other side of the sea, and it began to storm. The wind came up and began to blow the waves into the boat, and it was so turbulent, they were beginning to sink. He was up in the stern, or is it back in the stern? Fred, you don't know. Which was it? He was up in the stern, I guess. He was up in the stern. Is there a sailor in the house? He was up in the bow, asleep on a pillow. Matthew, or I think it's Mark that records it. Matthew doesn't record that he was asleep on the pillow. But anyway, they said, "Lord, wake up, we're sinking." And he was aroused out of his sleep, and he said, "Why were you afraid? Oh, men of little faith, why were you afraid?" Well, he did that at different times, and on other occasions still the storms. As far as the fear of the forces of evil, on one occasion perhaps 6 weeks before his death, he was over across the Jordan, where he was really hiding out. He was a fugitive. The Jews had tried to kill him to such an extent that he had fled to keep out of their reach. But he got a message from Mary and Martha that Lazarus was sick. And it says that he loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and he stayed there two more days across the river before he left to come and see what he could do. He stayed there long enough for Lazarus to die. And he did it on purpose. And then he made his way across the Jordan through Jericho, came up into the city of Jerusalem, into Bethany, and there he comforted these people just simply as a friend of the family. We've heard tonight notices read about people who are sick. Can you think of anything in the world that's read more often to those who are sick or to those who have lost loved ones than the statements of Jesus? He wept with Mary and Martha. The Jews saw this display of emotion and they said, look how he loved him. But Jesus went on and he was talking with Martha, and he said, Martha, Lazarus will rise again. And she said, I know, Lord, he will in the resurrection. Jesus then made this very famous statement, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes on me, though he die, yet shall he live. And he that lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said, yes, Lord, I do. I believe that you're the Christ that's coming into the world. And then they went from there out to the grave, and he said, where have you left him or where have you laid him? They said, come on, and we'll show you. And on the way out there, he began to cry. He was there as the friend of the family. But the real comfort comes not only to Lazarus's family. It comes down to us in the times of our sickness and of the death of our friends and loved ones when he says, I am the resurrection and the life. What about the guilt of sin? Did Jesus speak to the crisis of the guilt of sin? He did. Early in his ministry, Simon Peter and the other disciples were, though they had been called earlier, it seems that they didn't really understand the call to be permanent. And we find them again in Luke's gospel back down on the Sea of Galilee fishing. It's hard to get a fisherman away from his boats and away from his fishing. He was down there again, and Jesus was in the boat. He had asked Simon, Simon, put out just a ways and let me have use of your boat. So Simon did, and he sat there and taught the people. And then he told Simon, let out into the deep and let down your nets for a draught. Simon said, well, Lord, we worked all night and we caught nothing, but at your word we will. So you know the story. A humongous catch of fish that began to break the nets, began to sink two boats, Simon Peter's and Andrew's, his brother, and James and John, their helper. All these men were about 5 or 6 miles north of Capernaum. And they began to sink both of the boats, and Simon was just dumbfounded. And you can see him just kneeling in those slimy, flopping fish and saying, Lord, get away from me. I'm a sinful man. And then I told you some 2 or 3 weeks ago, this beautiful statement, or at the first of the year, these two words, do you remember the two words? Don't be afraid from now on. Don't be afraid from now on. I guarantee you, you could search high and low from now to the end of time, you'd never find two words back to back, two expressions back to back that mean so much to sinners like Simon Peter and me. Don't be afraid, Simon. From now on, you're going to catch men. Encouragement, comfort. So that people, though they were astonished by his presence, he just simply spent his life saying, don't you be afraid. Come on. Be of good courage. Be of good heart. When Jesus met the woman taken in adultery, you know the story as well as I do. They threw her into the midst. And Jesus then, you know, stooped down, and they were wanting him to stone her or wanting him to give judgment on it. And he wouldn't. He dismissed them with the classic statement, let him that's without sin among you cast the first stone. And then he turned to the woman and said, dear lady, where are your accusers? She said, I have none, Lord. He said, neither do I condemn you. You go and don't you sin anymore. Comfort and encouragement. Simon Peter came to him one day and said, Lord, how many times should I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Should I forgive him as many as 7 times? Jesus said, oh, Simon, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. You say, why are you quoting that? Why is that comfort? For this simple reason. Jesus would not have told Simon to forgive 70 times 7 unless that were the philosophy by which he himself lived. I know what Jesus does to me and does to you by knowing what he did to Simon. He said, Simon, you ought to forgive people 70 times 7. In other words, just keep on forgiving them as often as they come to you. In fact, on another occasion, or at least another record of it, says, if the man or your brother sins against you 7 times in a day, I think it may say that if he does the same thing 7 times a day, I'm not sure of that, but he says, and comes back and says, I'm sorry, you must forgive him. And then about 60 years after this kind of goings on among people with whom Jesus associated, John wrote in his gospel in chapter 3, in verse 17, after the statement, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. After John made that statement, that wasn't made by Jesus. This was a statement made by John 60 years after Jesus had gone back to his Father. Then John said, for God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. That statement of genuine comfort to all people who come to God as sinners, it cannot be discounted. What about worth and self-image? Did Jesus deal with that? Yes, he did. And a lot of people are troubled with it. How many of you are troubled with self-image right now? You feel like you're not worth much. You feel like that just, you know, you're just nothing. I deal with a lot of people like that. I talk to them. I try to counsel them. How many of you feel that you're just not worth very much? Jesus lived among people like that. On one occasion when he was in the synagogue, we don't know what town, but he was one of the synagogues, and they brought a man there that had a withered hand. They asked him, trying him and to tempt him, they said, is it right to heal on the Sabbath or not? Trying to catch him. And Jesus said, which of you having one sheep, if he falls into a pit, will not reach down and lift him out on the Sabbath day? And then he asked this very beautiful question, of how much more value is a man than a sheep? Now you think about what the thinking of the people was as he gets down and grapples with this basic issue of the worth of the human individual. Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? And then the parables that he told about how the shepherd would leave the 99 sheep in a group in the fold and would go out looking for that one sheep that was lost. On another occasion, a man interrupted him from his teaching. Standing there in the crowd, it says, the man spoke up and said, Teacher, make my brother divide the inheritance with me. Though Jesus spoke this word to him in this context, he said, be careful and beware of all covetousness, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. That was stated in perhaps a different context, but the overflow, the fallout to the common people who didn't have much, there weren't many people in the times of Jesus that had very much. Those that had much, much. But those who didn't have much of anything. And they outnumbered those who had by I don't know how many, thousands to one. It was these people, the thousands who didn't have much, who got the overflow out of this statement, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things. And the common man could stand there and just rejoice in the glory and the honor in the ordinary that Jesus gave when he said that a man's life just doesn't consist in things. Same thing he did when the poor widow came by the treasury in the temple. They were sitting there one day, and he was watching people come by and drop in their gifts. And he watched the rich people drop in just maybe bags full. And here came this poor widow. And she had 2 tiny farthings, or 2 mites, rather, that make a farthing. And perhaps even just, I don't know what her gesture was, but she put those in the collection. Jesus said, come here. He said, you see that lady? She's put in more than all the rest of them. Because they've contributed out of their wealth, she's contributed her very living. The worth of the individual. Oh, and you remember the story you do that he told about the Pharisee and the publican who went up to the temple to pray? You see, the Pharisee represented the ins, the up and ins. The publican represented the down and outs. And there were more down and outs than there were up and ends, just like today. There are more irreligious people than there are religious. There are more non-church people than there are church people. Jesus put his stamp of recognition upon the genuine, sincere, ungodly person, or who recognized that he was ungodly, when the publican said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. While the Pharisee stood there and prayed with himself, I'm glad I'm not like other people. Jesus put his stamp upon this man and said, this man went home justified rather than the other one. The common individual, the common person, was comforted in this sense of self-worth and self-image. About 10 days before he was killed, he was coming through Jericho, and you know the story about Zacchaeus, the little short tax collector. He wanted to see Jesus, and he'd heard about him as being a friend of tax collectors and sinners, no doubt, and looking at him, wanting to get a glimpse of him, and sure enough, he did. There he came. But he had to get up in a tree to do it, and he was sitting there watching him, no doubt longingly wishing that he could have some association with that good man. And sure enough, Jesus stopped and said, Zacchaeus, come on, I'm going home with you. And he was so tickled. It just says he made haste. He just got plumb excited and came down out of that tree. And you know what Jesus said about him? Whenever the people criticize him, he's gone in to be the guest of a man that's a sinner. Jesus said, today salvation has come to this house. For this man also is a son of Abraham. This man who? This tax collector. He's also a son of Abraham. And then he makes this beautiful statement. For the Son of Man came to seek and save that which is lost. He gave worth to the individual. Regarding death, the somber guest that's going to visit every one of us. My wife and I were passing by the cemetery out here on Moore Street the other day. And I looked and saw all those tombstones. Do you realize that your name will be on one of those one day? Ed, your name will be there, mine will. Your wife may be there first. Your husband may be there before you. It's unlikely that both of you will go at the same time. Your mother and father will be there before you if the normal lifespan transpires. Jesus was there and present as a friend, as we mentioned a moment ago, with Mary and Martha, as at the death of Lazarus. What about the unknown? Was he a comforter there? His comfort in death is seen every time there's a funeral. All over America, thousands of times a day, the words of Jesus are read at death. But he was also gifted at trying to comfort people about the unknown. The last night of his life, the book of John, chapters 13 through 17, record that intimate relationship and intimate conversation between him and his disciples. As he told them in John 14, trying to prepare them for the unknown, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms or mansions. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And when I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and take you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Later on that night, after they had left the garden, after they had left the upper room and were on the way out to the garden, or were perhaps in the garden, in the 16th chapter, John records that he told his disciples this, yet a little while, and I'll be with you no more. Again a little while, and you'll see me. Some of his disciples said to one another, what is this that he says to us, a little while, and you'll not see me, and again a little while, and you will see me? And what does he mean, because I go to the Father? They said, what does he mean by a little while? We don't know what he means. Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. So he said to them, is this what you are asking yourselves? What I meant by saying a little while and you'll not see me, and again a little while you will see me? Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy. So even before the sorrow came, here he was busy preparing them for this that was to take place that may very well overwhelm them. But he said, you mustn't become discouraged. Later on, he makes a similar statement in this same 16th chapter. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And all the way through this, he was trying to encourage these people and comfort them and to not let the sorrow that was about to come upon them overwhelm them. And then later on, after his resurrection, one of the first things he said to the women who were there as they met him on the road into Jerusalem, they took a hold of his feet, Matthew records it, and he said, don't be afraid. I think in regard to the unknown and to his resurrection, you know the story that is told, Luke records it in Luke, the 24th chapter. Cleopas, who perhaps could have been Jesus' uncle, he could have been Mary's sister's husband. John records his name as Clopas, C-L-O-P-A-S. But this man in Luke 24, his name is C-L-E-O-P-A-S, Cleopas. Whether they're the same man, we don't know. But anyway, these men, Clopas or Cleopas, and a friend of his were on their way out of Jerusalem to a little town about 12 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And they were on their way there that Sunday evening talking. And they were very, very deeply immersed as they went toward Emmaus in a very somber, solemn conversation. Jesus, or it says this stranger, a man came and went along with them. And he drew up beside them and said, "What are you men talking about so seriously?" They said, "Oh, the things that have happened in Jerusalem." He said, "What things?" And they more or less stopped and said, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem that doesn't know the things that have happened?" He said, "What things?" They said, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, a man, a prophet, mighty in deed and word." And then they go ahead and tell how that their rulers killed him. And he listened attentively, let them say it all. And they said, "We thought that he would be the one that would redeem Israel. But now it's been 3 days. And more than that," he said, "some of our women were there, and they amazed us. They said that they saw, they were at the tomb early in the morning and didn't find his body. And they came back saying that they had seen even a vision of angels who said that Jesus was alive." Well, they went on toward the city of Emmaus. And he said to them, after they made these observations and poured their heart out and so discouraged they were, Jesus, it seems, figuratively or literally, reached out his hands, put his arms around these men, and those three men walked on toward Emmaus. And he said, "Men, did you not know that it was necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? Didn't you know that?" And then it says he began with those very thoughts and went into the Moses and the Old Testament scriptures and began to tell them all these things about him that had to be fulfilled. Took the time to give them this bolstering encouragement. They went inside the house. He was going to go on. He made like he was. They said, "Come on in. It's getting late." And he said, "All right." And they went inside and closed the door and sat down. And the one that lived there, I suppose, went and got the food, put bread on the table and a drink, and they sat around the table and were going to eat. And he said, "We'll give thanks." And as he broke the bread and gave thanks, they recognized who he was. And he vanished out of their sight. They turned to each other and said, "Didn't our hearts burn within us while we were on the way?" As he unveiled the scriptures to us. Encouragement, comfort. Why would he take the time to stop and talk to these two very discouraged, despondent men? We had thought he was the one that would redeem Israel, because that was his nature, comforter. Well, they went on back into the city. They began to tell, or started to tell about it, and found out that others had already seen him also, that Simon Peter had already seen him. And then Jesus stood in their midst and said, "Don't be afraid. Why were you troubled? Why do you have these questions in your heart?" Well, he was a comforter. From beginning to end, he seemed to major in comforting people, because there were so many people distraught and who needed the comfort. He gave much. He received little. He had none of the ordinary comforts, such as a home and family. He said to one man, "Foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests. I don't even have a place to lay my head." And yet he was the one who said, "In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world." And then those men were led by that good man out from Jerusalem near Bethany. And having told them, "I'll be with you always, I'll always be with you," he raised his hand and blessed them, told them to stay in the city until they were endued with power from on high, and he was taken up from them. But he was always interested in comforting people. Today I need him. I think you do too. In times of anxiety, I need him. Fear, feelings of guilt over sin, when I'm faced with death, when I'm faced with the unknown. I need this comfort. And Jesus is full of it. And God bless his memory. Let's hold him up and look at him and love him. Let our hearts trail after him and do obeisance. What do you think about him? Well, this is just another picture we're going to get as we go along and see him as he is. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian and you'd like to become his follower, you can. He requires that you die with him like he died, in a spiritual sense, that you put to death the old nature. Let it be buried in a grave of baptism and let it be raised to walk a new life. He'll spend the rest of your life comforting you and letting you comfort other people. Would you like to accept him? And if you're here as a Christian and you need his comfort through us personally and individually, we urge you to come while we stand and sing.